On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Begin this Titanic Tuesday on the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. For this edition, the 26th day of August 2014, August is running away, as is the summer itself. Hope you've had a good summer. It's been an okay summer here. Not a great summer, but an okay summer. But I hope yours has been magnificent. Yes, 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 HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home, and I suspect there's probably going to be a, at some point during the program, with any luck at all, you won't notice it, but there's going to be a restart of the production computer here in fairly short order. It seems to want one. Oh, well. No, this is Titanic Tuesday, and we're going to be having a conversation in fairly short order that I think you will find interesting. Good evening to everyone in the chat room. You know, you go to HeadOnRadioNetwork.com to get into the Horn chat room, a wonderful interactive multimedia experience for the that serves as an adjunct to the program itself. Good evening, Jeremy. Good evening, Imbrant. Good evening, Paul. Good evening, longtime veteran chat room moderators Lottie and Sparky. Good evening. Good evening. Good evening. I'm sure that more folks will be wandering by in fairly short order. Also at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, the pop-out player that makes it easy to listen from a PC. If you're on some sort of iThis or SmartThat or Android other, a reminder that we recommend the apps from Stitcher and TuneIn, with the understanding, of course, that none of the ads you see there actually go toward the support of this program. You might see an ad for Amalgamated Widget or Toxic Chemical Incorporated, but please understand, we have no control over the running of those ads, neither do we derive any benefit from them. No corporate ads on the Horn. Nope, 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 nope. And in fact, we're not selling anything. We don't have anything to sell. All we do is create a little community here that people can participate in as they choose and support as they choose. The PayPal button is also at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, and that's how we keep all of this on the air. We try to raise $150 on any given evening to keep the whole thing running. So if you want to, if you like the Horn, if the Horn matters to you, and if you are at all able so to do, especially if you never have, it is much appreciated if you would go to take a step, click the button. You can also use the traditional United States Postal Service method, but check in and perhaps support the program by going to the PayPal button. We, like I said, try to raise $150 on any given evening, which is kind of a, well, it's a relatively tiny amount when you consider what other media venues charge and what, you know, things like salaries and so forth. As I said, we are going to have a conversation in fairly short order, and I wanted to have this conversation because one of my good friends over on Facebook is a woman of real piercing intellect and brilliant wit. You can find her on Facebook. She is Carol Baker, and she has written a piece called Especially When It Rains. It was published yesterday at HearWomenTalk.com, HearWomenTalk.com. And it is based upon her 2 days of experience in Ferguson, Missouri, because she lives not far from Ferguson and went there to report in her own way on what was going on there, and came away. And I honestly don't think that writing like this can be deliberate. There is too much painful beauty here. There is too much earnest and honest outrage. And I simply suggest that you go to HearWomenTalk.com and look for Especially When It Rains. But with a bit of background and perhaps a bit of content that may not even be in the piece itself, I want to take a moment to welcome Carol to the broadcast. Hey, Carol.
Hi, how are you? Can you hear me okay?
I hear you great, and you sound wonderful.
Thank you.
We'll do a little background stuff here in a minute, but I want to get to, there is so much immediacy to this. What is the present parlance for this? I mean, we used to call these things articles when they were published in things called newspapers. It seems a bit too small to call it an op-ed. This is really, really candid on the ground reportage mixed with essay. Is that a safe assessment?
Yeah, I would consider myself an essayist, and I've kind of retreated into the land of blogging. I call it writing a column every week. But being as close as I was, you know, I turned on the television, and of course, when you turn on Fox, you get Bernie Kerik, who is a convicted liar, talking about how wonderful the police are. And when you turn on CNN, you get Mark O'Mara, who defended George Zimmerman, talking about what a good shoot this was in Ferguson. And when you realize that there's not really going to get any truth on television, and when you live this close and you're somebody who just really has a yearning to understand why there's such angst, why there's such unrest in that community, and you're that close and you have the ability to go there, then if you really want to know the truth, then you have to go there. And the trick is to not talk and to simply listen.
And of course, that one trick right there, Carol, is something that most of the for-profit media are incapable of comprehending, because they have to talk.
I didn't go in there with an agenda. I went in with a genuine desire to understand and to realize that the reason that we live in such a deeply divided left-right, religious, non-religious, black-white paradigm in this country is because we have a tendency to like live within this ideological bubble. And we don't really have a desire to try and see the other person's point of view. And that's what this truth is really about.
Well, within the confines of time itself, when were you there, Carol?
I was there on Tuesday and Wednesday of last week.
And I'll note that I follow you with something approaching religiosity on Facebook. I get a charge out of the stuff you write generally, and a lot of times I find myself clutching my sides laughing, and you can be as sharp as a tack and cut without the victim knowing he or she has been cut until far too late. But this is none of that. You have a paragraph in here in which you say, "We are a country that can run but can't hide. It's time to stop pretending we live in a post-racial society because we have a black president. It's time to stop pretending we can resolve our differences with empty words and blue ribbon commissions. It's time to stop pretending we can repeal the legal safeguards put in place half a century ago to level the playing field between the races. We have to stop pretending because although we happen to occupy the same landmass, we sure as hell aren't all living in the same country. Those are mighty powerful words for starters. Did you come into Ferguson feeling that way, or is that something that happened there?
No, it was something that I had heard other people say, you can never understand. And I think what happened was I walked away, and once you've had police with no name tags and no badges pointing guns at people who literally are not doing anything illegal, and then I walk past the same officer within the same proximity and get a much different reaction, not polite necessarily, but certainly I never felt that my life was threatened, then you get this sense that there's a safety that comes with having a lack of melanin in your skin. And it was just pervasive everywhere I went.
You had specific interactions with police, though, that were wild, were considerably different,
yes,
from experiences you had with, say, somebody standing 4 feet away from you. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the interesting thing was I was there for one night of the militarization and the tear gas, and I will tell you, if I never live through that again, I will be fine with that, because I'm basically a big chicken who wants to live to be an old woman. But I don't regret any of it. And then there was a police officer standing in a street corner, and he was wearing black slacks and a white uniform top, and he had on his badge clearly and his name tag clearly. And I walked up to him and I said, "Sir, could I talk to you for just a minute? I'm a writer and I'm curious about something." And he said, "Sure." And I said, "You're wearing your badge and your name tag." And that was a very, very thing to see over the course of that 2 days. And I said, "Why aren't you following their lead?" And he said, "I have served this community proudly for 31 years behind this badge, and I don't take it off for anybody or anything." And right there, you get that realization that here's a guy who plans on being helpful and doing everything within the confines of the law. When officers take off their badges and their name tags, they're not planning on being helpful, and they're not planning on necessarily performing everything in a lawful manner. And you don't see that when white people do it. When I wrote about the kids at Penn State, you know, when Joe Paterno got fired, those kids rioted and turned over cars and set fires. And you didn't see the National Guard called in, and you didn't see MRAPs and automatic weapons and riot police, because those wacky college kids, you know how they can be. But when it's a black community who, and this is a very complicated, there was a very complicated lead up to this whole Michael Brown shooting. And it has to do with race, and it has to do with class, and it has to do with systematic racism and institutional racism and economic disparity and wealth gaps and opportunity. And it was the shooting was just sort of a microcosm of everything that kind of led up to that, and how it was handled certainly spoke to how powerless they feel. You know, I lived in Chicago during the riots there, and I will tell you that when people who are powerless and feel very helpless and they feel like they don't have anything left to lose, they will behave in ways that people who have a lot to lose don't understand. They will burn your cities down. Because at some point they feel so helpless that they feel like it's the only way to, and they were.
And that phrase you just used, they will burn your cities down. that speaks volumes, Carol, because if I understand you correctly, there is a certain element in this society, whether it be a racial distinction or a class distinction, where people no longer feel a sense of community. Well, it's beyond involvement. It's just not a community, even.
It's not, and they don't feel like this is their country. Ferguson is a perfect example of white flight. This was a traditionally white area. Then, of course, the realtors all got together. This was a very political thing. The black community was essentially herded. They were only approved for loans in within confined areas as a form of economic segregation. And once they got the black community all concentrated in these areas, then the white people felt better about it because, of course, you know, they weren't in their neighborhoods and they knew which side of the town they weren't supposed to go on. And, you know, and we've seen it in Chicago. We've seen it in other major cities. But it's documented.
I want to back up to the tear gas, if I could, for just a minute, Carol. You said if you never experience that again, it'll be too soon. Did you come away from Ferguson with anything other than an understanding that something like tear gas? I mean, there's the argument put forward is, you know, crowd control, and then I suppose the other end of the spectrum is this is a form of warfare. Where do you fall on that continuum?
I think that how we police people is very different based on the color of our skin. When a rancher in Nevada and all of his homosexual friends can point loaded long guns at federal officials and get his cattle back and run the feds off and he's still on the land and nothing is being done about it, and yet when a bunch of black citizens rise up and say, this isn't right, this isn't fair, they're met with paramilitary-style policing, you know. And Ferguson is a very interesting, all of St. Louis is, and a lot of major metropolitan areas, the police no longer, there's no such thing as community policing. These guys don't get out of their cars and walk the neighborhoods and talk to the kids and meet them.
Yeah, these aren't beat cops.
No. These are cops who police the streets from their cars, and they're not proactive, they're reactive to everything. And a couple of weeks ago, there was a situation where a couple of squad cars in Kansas City had blocked off a side street. And the cops got out and were talking to the kids and met them and started this pickup basketball game with them on the street. And you should have heard the people in Kansas City complaining because those cops were just wasting time. And I'm sitting there thinking, those cops are absolutely investing in this community. They allowed these kids they looked at these kids as human beings, allowed the kids to see them as people. These police officers now know these kids and have a relationship with them. And this is a neighborhood that is now going to be far easier for them to police. And if there was more of that, then I think that you would find far fewer problems than you're finding right now. But when you have police that are merely reactive, who only come when they're called in a time of crisis, and, of course, now they're all ramboed up, and they've got the guns drawn, and they're ready to go, and we don't ask questions. The brutalization of the average citizen by police officers is disconcerting. And that is not to say that I believe that all police officers are bad.
No.
And I know they're not because I met one on a street corner wearing a badge and a name tag.
But Baron, you said that police officer claimed to have had 31 years experience.
Yes.
But you did not have a similar experience with some fresh-faced, shiny, new 23-24-year-old police officer, did you?
No. As a matter of fact,
it's a cultural. I mean, there's a culture within policing as well, and you experience the divide in the cultural divide within the police itself.
There truly is, but I have to tell you that I feel like they really took the lead from, they were taking the lead from other people. I think that nowadays, peaceful protests like the ones that spontaneously broke out, and they were largely peaceful to begin with in Ferguson, the idea is to crush those before they even get started. And the Occupy Wall Street people taught the police officers very well how to quell those. That's when you saw all the ordinances being passed, when people couldn't pitch tents and they couldn't do it within certain hours and they couldn't have bullhorns. You go into the Wisconsin Capitol, you can't have a sign. It's that kind of thing. They simply just pass ordinances to just squeeze it out to where it's essentially toothless.
So during the time that you were there, Carol, was mm-hmm. this during the keep moving, you can't sit down, you can't?
Yes. Yes.
What did you get out of that?
Well, what I got out of that was, it was the whole point of that, I think, was to simply just exhaust them. It was a matter of merely exhausting them, and it was keeping them from talking. When you have people that are moving, and they weren't just being told that they had to move. They had to move at a fairly brisk pace, or else you had the officers telling them to hurry up and move along. And I have yet to see anywhere in the Constitution where it says your constitutional rights are dependent upon how quickly you can march while you're doing it.
And this was applied across the board, young and old, correct?
It was applied across the board, young and old. There was a sweet elderly black lady who had been out there for hours. I saw her out there for hours. And she finally sat down on a curb and started to take her shoes off when an armed police officer came up and got right in her face and started yelling at her to get up and get moving, or he would arrest her. And she looked up at him and she said, "Son, I'm old and my feet hurt." And he goes, "I don't care." He goes, "This, you have to keep moving. No static pro-." She goes, "I'm not protesting. I'm resting." And when I walked over and helped her to her feet, that's when he walked away. I think when he saw a white face, that's when he just walked away.
God almighty.
So, yeah. And it wasn't, and again, I'm not trying to paint this as that all cops are racist. It isn't about that. There was this militarized culture of just get these people out of here.
Well, and there's conscious versus unconscious too, isn't there?
Of course there is. Of course there is, but I will tell you, I was not there on Saturday, but a friend of mine was, and he was live tweeting and sending photos and sending vines, and he went over to watch the counter-protest that was being staged for Officer Wilson. Now, that protest took place just around the corner from the police union hall. They were allowed to pitch these easy-up, pop-up shade tents.
Oh, yes.
They brought their lawn chairs. They had beer coolers. I posted a picture there of a guy out with his, Officer Wilson is a hero while he's got a beer tipped up sign. Why not in the open on the street? And police are going by like every 3 minutes, honking their horn, giving them the thumbs up.
Wait, doesn't Ferguson, Missouri have a an open container law?
Yeah, well, but since I'm not the person who has to enforce it, the police weren't interested in enforcing it. They were there to make sure, you know, and the head of the protest got up. She got up and gave this, "We are not afraid. We will not be afraid." And I thought, of course you're not afraid. You're sitting there getting this wonderful treatment from the police, and no one's allowed to bother you. There are no armed officers. While just a few blocks away, there were more than 300 protesters on a forced march down the avenue in 100-degree heat with a street lined with armed officers that are staring at them with hate in their eyes.
Were the snipers and the machine gunners still there by the time you arrived, Carol?
Oh, yeah. I was there the night that they brought in the MRAPs, and they were all ramboed up in the riot gear and the guns, and they just made this line. And I will, and the night before I'd been, and this is kind of what moved me to go, was the night before I'd been sitting in my house, and I've got an app that allows me to monitor police frequencies. And so I had like all of the St. Louis police frequencies on. They had made it clear that they wanted the streets cleared that night by 9 o'clock. And at about 9:05, someone took like one of those single-serve like Nestle water bottles,
mm-hmm.
and it hit one of the MRAPs, literally went ping, and that's when all hell broke loose.
That's when the police riot started.
That's when the police riot started, and it was a police riot. It wasn't. This was not citizens rioting. This was. You knew exactly who came for the fight by who was dressed for it, and it was not the citizens of Ferguson. And I got to tell you, it was like it. And then the next day, the next morning, I got up as I'm packing and I'm getting ready to leave, and I'm hearing that bottles were thrown at police, and that's why they felt moved to move in on the protesters. Well, bottles were not thrown at police. Someone threw a plastic water bottle that bounced off of an armored vehicle, and I realized that that's going to probably cause some post-traumatic stress syndrome for some police officers. Boys, you know, there comes a time where we have to exercise a little bit of restraint.
Not the water bottle. Anything but the water bottle.
Yeah, anything but that Nestle bottle. It could have been an Avion. It could have been, you know, anything but Nestle's. But the next day when I was there, it was like, that's when, that was just when.
How much of a logistical nightmare was it just to get there, Carol?
It was pretty bad because you had people stopping you. There was law enforcement stopping you every step of the way, trying to keep you from getting there. I had to park several miles away and walk in. And I have to tell you that at no time did I ever feel intimidated by any of the residents. I never felt scared. My whiteness never made me felt scared. Just, you know, and I will be honest, my black friend said that I must have looked like a marshmallow in a box of raisins, which made me laugh. But, which in retrospect I did. But, the police were doing everything to keep this thing from getting bigger. And the way to do that is to keep people from the outside from coming in. And yet remarkably, the night that I saw the riot, the next morning on the news, they were talking about Molotov cocktails being thrown. When in fact, they had pulled aside a pickup truck that had 10 individuals in the back. They did have a Molotov cocktail. Now, they failed to mention that 8 of those individuals were white and that they were all from Chicago. So they never bothered to share the fact that there were outside provocateurs coming in an attempt to get the police to riot on these people.
Do you have any sense of what the operating philosophy was of those who did that?
Of those who came in from the outside?
The provocateurs.
I got the sense that they were part of hate groups, that their mission is to start a race war.
Jesus.
And I have no proof of that, but when you looked at the white faces and you saw the shaved heads and you saw the tattoos, everything about that said white supremacist group, and I would know that because we have probably 25 of them here in Missouri, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. But in the end, what I walked away with was just a better understanding that I really didn't understand, that as much as I had empathy for Michael Brown's family, and for as much as I had empathy for his mother as a woman and as a mother, that there were things going on there that you could not really get a grasp on without being on the ground. And I was treated extraordinarily well by the citizens of Ferguson.
Do you think the situation would have benefited, and I'm not even sure that's the right word, Carol, but would the situation have benefited from more white allies?
No, I think, I'm not sure that that was even the case, because I don't think they even saw me that way. The interesting thing, when I met the woman, I was down on the street where Michael Brown was actually shot. And I was standing on the sidewalk, and there was a woman going into her house. And, again, I stopped her and asked her if she had a few moments to talk. I told her that I was a writer. And people had a natural suspicion because they don't trust the media, and they have a reason not to trust the media. And I don't think that they really had a concept that there was a difference between me as not being a media person, but merely being someone who is going to write about this in a very different way than probably anyone would expect a white woman in her mid-50s to write about it. But I asked her what it was that was bothering her about the whole thing more than anything else. And this whole idea that a teenager who did not have a gun, who was shot by a police officer, regardless of any of the things that came before it or even during or after, that his body was left to lay in the street for 4.5 hours. And they didn't do anything to treat the human remains with dignity. They left his body uncovered for more than 2 hours. And finally, they threw a sheet over him. And then after that, they threw a tarp over him. But he was a big kid, and his feet were sticking out the bottom. And then the blood trail from the head wound was the street slopes there. And the blood had run down the street probably about 10 or 12 feet. And she said, you know how white folks pose with animals that they kill? And she said, that's what it feels like to us.
It's not like there isn't a history.
Exactly. And I couldn't speak when she said that. I literally couldn't speak. And I looked at her for a long time. And it was at that moment when she reached up and she touched my face. And she said, child, you're not talking. And I said, that's because I came to listen. And she said, that's what makes you different.
I doubt you'll ever forget it, but you'll be a while getting over it, won't you?
I don't want to get over it. That's just it, is that I don't ever want the impact and the gravity of, for the first time, being able to see something through someone else's eyes in a way that I could never have done without taking a chance. And it was a big chance because it was a very dangerous place for a couple of days. And again, it wasn't the citizens that you had to be worried about. It was most certainly the police. But the warmth and the welcoming that I got from those citizens was, it was not expected. I thought that they would be very mistrusting simply because I was white, and they weren't. The more I sat and didn't say anything and just let them talk, the more surprised they were, because I got the feeling that no one had ever done that before.
I think that's probably 100% accurate. Let me take you back for just a minute to what you were talking about, the way that Michael Brown's body was treated.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain expectations, or at least there have been in this country. I think we are rapidly becoming a very different country from what even the country was that you and I, because we are of similar age, were raised to think it was.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Brown's body was left there in excess of 4 hours, covered by a sheet, covered by a tarp, left to bleed out into the street. But sooner or later, you expect certain basic levels of conduct to prevail, like sending an ambulance to take away a body.
Yes.
Now, that wasn't even afforded to his lifeless being, was it?
It was not. I learned that there was a doctor and a nurse in the crowd immediately after the shooting who had asked police officers to attend to Michael Brown, and they were denied access to him. And while I don't believe that there was any chance that he could have survived, it's troublesome to think that a doctor and a nurse would not have been given access to him to at least check for a pulse or do whatever, and to at least attend to it, because I do believe that his body would have been covered. I don't believe that any evidence would have been disturbed. It wasn't like that. But here is a crowd of 100, and the police now blame the crowd that had assembled around there, who were obviously very upset and getting more upset as the hours ticked by. And so the police were saying, well, the reason that the body wasn't covered up was because, you know, we were too busy doing crowd control. Well, those people were not swarming the police. They
no, the video, the video's out there. There's nobody raging or rampaging.
No, there really wasn't. Now, his stepfather did attempt to, or it was either his father or stepfather, got a phone call and went and tried to walk up to him and were backed off behind the yellow tape. But...
And yet there is video of Officer Wilson pacing back and forth and back and forth and standing and looking at Michael Brown's corpse.
Absolutely. And so now these people are sitting there, after 4 hours have gone by, they're sitting there going, okay, so what's the point in leaving his body out here? Is it to let us know that if we bother the police or question the police, that this could be us? That was what they were saying to me.
Well, and again, one need not go very far down the Google search hole before one begins to find pictures of white people leaving people of color strung up in trees as a warning.
Well, and it isn't exactly like the police don't have a history of not necessarily telling the truth. There's a case down in Louisiana right now of a young man who was handcuffed. He handcuffed behind his back, and yet police are trying to make us believe that he shot himself in the front.
Yes. The autopsy report, the coroner's inquest or whatever it was, well, the pathology report shows that he was shot from the front in a downward angle, which he managed to do with handcuffs behind his back.
Yes.
It beggars credulity.
Yeah.
But another thing has come to light, and that's one of the frustrations of a situation like this, is that it seems that information comes out based upon what the authorities want people to know. We know, for instance, that the New York Times article, what was it yesterday, as Michael Brown was being buried, the New York Times, in an act of absolutely tone deaf, shamelessness, it published an article that was basically a character assassination of Michael Brown.
Exactly.
And you ask yourself, you know, who's sitting there in the offices of the New York Times saying, hey, yeah, this is a good idea. Who's the editor?
Well, interestingly, someone had the presence of mind to take that piece that the New York Times did on Michael Brown and set it side by side with a piece that the New York Times did on Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber.
Oh, my God.
After they knew what he did. And they had all of these glowing things to say about Ted Kaczynski, about what a quiet man he was and how he didn't bother his neighbors and how he didn't do this and that. And I'm sitting there thinking, this is a guy who murdered I don't know how many people, but, you know.
But he didn't listen to the rap music nor smoke the marijuana.
There you go. And I have to say that if you took everything that was written in that New York Times article and just take out the rap music, change the date, and put my name in, I did all of those things as a teenager.
I experienced the same thing reading the article. I, I, I guess I should have been shot down in the street. Is that what the New York Times is trying to convey, that summary execution by the police is to be expected in 21st century America?
But, you know, this is one of those times when I absolutely love social media. If you took to Twitter yesterday, the hashtag, I deserved it, a lot of people were listing all of the stupid, childish things that they did, and they said, okay, well, I lied to my mom, and I skipped catechism, so if I'm shot by the cops, could you tell the New York Times I deserved it? And there were probably there were thousands of these yesterday on Twitter. And I just sat and read them for the longest time, and I thought, you know, that's America saying, I don't accept this. And it was gratifying.
Hey, well, yeah, but I wonder how hard is it to pierce the veil of privilege that apparently hangs over not just the New York Times, but a whole lot of the what I refer to as the for-profit media in this country. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, that's why after I sat and I watched these people on TV interviewing absolutely the worst possible people they could think of to weigh in on their opinions on this, I thought, why am I listening to this? It's right over there. All I have to do is get in the car. It's a couple of hours, and I'm there. And it was a gift. It was a gift. And it doesn't change what happened. It doesn't change anything. But in America, there is a white woman who walked away with an understanding. And I'm going to quote James Baldwin again. He said, I'm not interested in anybody's guilt. Guilt is a luxury we can no longer afford. I know you didn't do it, and I didn't do it either. But I'm responsible for it because I am a man and a citizen of this country, and you are responsible for it for the very same reason.
And that is so easy to comprehend, and yet how many times over have we heard, Carol, and not, you know, not just within the context of Ferguson, but in the overall context of, well, I never owned any slaves, or, you know, my grandparents were immigrants to America after slavery had already been ended. I don't have any responsibility. That's like saying that you only moved into the neighborhood 2 weeks ago, so therefore, if somebody's house burns down tomorrow, you have no obligation to call the fire department.
Well, those are the same people who will live in red states and accept their food stamps and their disability and then squawk about how evil the government is. Those are the people who use words like thug and animal to describe the residents of Ferguson, and they think that if I don't say the word nigger out loud, then I'm not a racist.
Right, because we can think it all day long. But they don't get that it's the thinking of it that creates the problem in the first place. No, there's something, and I think I've read James Baldwin as well, and there is something he points to there's a cancer inside this country that we have steadfastly, and especially white culture mostly, has steadfastly avoided trying to even acknowledge. And in a way, since there's so much of it running through the communities here in Appalachia, cancer is what, you know, there are people who won't even say the word.
Yeah.
And it's the same kind of mindset, really. I want to ask you to tell a story, if I may, please.
Sure.
This is outside the column. But I was reading the other day, and I think it's important that we understand that this isn't a Ferguson thing, and it's not a black communities thing. And I'm not trying to take anything away from what has happened in Ferguson or in any other community that has been brutalized. But the police attitude in this country is one that has gotten it started getting bad in the 90s. You know, that's when we know that the federal government started passing out M-raps and machine guns and whatnot, like gumballs out of a penny, well, it's a nickel machine or a quarter machine.
Which only exacerbated after 9/11 when citizens were no longer citizens but potential terrorists.
Well, precisely. And so, consequently, a bad outcome with police can happen anywhere. And you actually had one on the way home one night not too long ago, didn't you?
It was actually a couple of years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. It was a situation where I had bought a vehicle, and when I bought the vehicle, the people left the plates on it and said, send it back. Just mail me the plates back. And I said, okay. Well, I was working probably 60 or 70 hours a week at the time, and I will be honest with you, I forgot about it. It doesn't excuse it, it doesn't make it okay, but I forgot about it. The people who sold me the vehicle reported the plates as stolen. So I get pulled over by the police. Okay, I didn't know what for at the time. It never occurred to me. So I'm sitting there, and the next thing you know, I'm surrounded by five county squad cars. Before I know it, I am face down in a ditch on a country road with three loaded service revolvers pointed at my head. And I was terrified. I was terrified. And that was the day that, you know, I was raised to believe that police officers were people that you went to when you were in trouble, that if you needed help, you could always find a police officer. You could always ask them for help. You should always trust the police. And my office at the time was literally right across the street from the county sheriff's office. I had a position where I was completely well-known within the community. They knew exactly who I was. And they took all the stuff out of my van and threw it on the ground in the ditch. And I'm in a business suit laying in the weeds on the side of a country road in Missouri. And eventually it all got sorted out, and they relaxed and let me go. And I picked all the stuff up out of the ditch and threw it in the back of my van and went to work and immediately walked across the street and asked to speak with the county sheriff himself. He looked mortified when I told him what happened, and he said, I'll find out. Well, the story they told him and the story I told him were vastly different.
Of course.
And he absolutely believed me. He found it completely credible. Now, he apologized in every way possible. He felt genuinely terrible about it, and he begged me not to make a big deal out of it. And because of the position that I had within the community at the time, no good could have come from me doing it. Now, while I didn't say anything about it and I didn't push it, I never forgot it, because it's the day that I lost my innocence when it came to trusting the police. And it was the day that I learned that it doesn't matter what color your skin is. These guys, there are some out there that just love doing this stuff. They love seeing.
They love the raw, aggressive exercise of naked power.
Yeah, and that really is kind of what it is. And then,
well, this dovetails with what was his name, Sanil Dutta's piece in the Washington Post last week, where he said, you know, just do as you're told, citizen.
I was mortified when I read that. Even if I'm violating your rights and I'm being abusive to you, shut your mouth and take it, or you're going to get it worse. And I was mortified when I read that, because I can only relate this to, after 9 years of being in an abusive relationship with a man, all I could think of was, this is the guy who's abusing me, and if I cry and say that you hurt me, then he tells me, I'm going to give you a reason to cry. And then when it's over, he says, see what you made me do?
And this whole country seems to be in that, and this whole country seems to be in that kind of a relationship on a number of fronts.
That's exactly.
Not only did you have that experience, but I was also thinking, Carol, about something you posted the other day about the cop who told you to quit following him.
Oh, that wasn't a cop.
Oh.
That was, I was coming home. It was just, this was just last week. It was a guy in a, he was dressed in military khaki.
Okay. Then that's my mistake. I extrapolated from done up all in military garb to, yeah.
No, he was in camouflage from head to toe and had his army boots on. And we live in a community where it's 20 miles an hour all the way through here. So it's not like we were going down a highway doing 60 and I was on his bumper. It wasn't even close. I was like 2 to 3 car lengths behind him, and he slams on the brake and gets out and does this whole road rage thing where he informs me to, you know, his exact words were get off his ass. And I got out of the car, and here's this guy that's a full head taller than me and 30 years younger. And I told him he was essentially lucky that I wasn't some crazy gun nut, because you don't get out of your car and confront people, and you're going to get shot. But we live in a country where everybody's angry and everybody thinks that the answer to everything is an in-your-face confrontation, because nobody can just talk. We're not interested in seeing the other person's side. We're not interested in standing in the other person's shoes. We're not interested in trying to get out of our own comfort zone and see our own culpability and in the human condition that we're living in this country. And that's really what the trip to Ferguson was all about. And it was about walking away as a woman of my age with the white privilege that I have, realizing that I have to own part of it.
And this is, I mean, this is becoming a very disturbing country. And the story you just told, well, both of those stories, what you experienced in Ferguson reinforces it. From my end of it, here in the wilds of almost level west by God, Virginia, it has not, even here, and we've rather of a reputation for Scots-Irish orneriness and cantankerousness, but even here it's gotten worse. A month ago, I went to a McDonald's. I know, I'll get hate mail. It was going to be a busy day, so I just ran down. We were going to get some Egg McYuckies or whatever for breakfast. I'm standing at the counter, and there's this guy over eating breakfast with the person I presume to be his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got this big old hog leg strapped to his hip.
Yeah.
Because he's too scared, Carol. He is too scared in America to go to McFreakin' Donald's without a deadly weapon on him. This is McDonald's. I mean, you pull into this one and say, you come play in our playland with your children.
Mm-hmm.
And we're supposed to be okay with that? I mean, I just have to trust that guy?
Well, but interestingly, that guy's okay. But the one man from the New Black Panther Party that was out directing traffic, completely unarmed in Ferguson, was written up in how many papers?
Oh, well, you know, if you go to Fox, and we had it, you know, I had the clip yesterday from Andrea Tanteros, oh my God, screeching that Eric Holder runs the DOJ like the Black Panthers.
Mm-hmm.
They live in this, but they do. They live in this terrified world. I went down to the, you know, when the program ends here, it's 9 p.m. Eastern, and that's kind of my 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
And so you can't just leave the studio and go and lay down for 8 hours and get up and, no, I mean, I'm going to be up for a few more hours. So usually, you know, I'll go out, go downtown, walk around a little bit, you know, what have you. So I decided to pop into the local Rippy Mart downtown, and I'm standing there in line, and I'm standing behind a guy who's got a pistol strapped to his leg because he literally could not go to the local convenience store to buy a can of snuff without being armed better than Marshall Dillon was. Now, and the reason I bring all of this up is to ask, of what are they afraid? And I think a part of it is the culture of fear that has been generated in this country by the NRA, by the Republican Party, by the white supremacists, by the John Birchers, by the libertarians, and it is, and even though the demographic ethnic makeup of the state of West Virginia is really pale, I think part and parcel of it is they're all, you know, they're going to have their gun with them when the race war starts.
Right. But look at who's armed.
Yeah.
It isn't the people they're afraid of.
No, it's the people who are going to take the and that's why I think there's, you know, there's this undercurrent of racism that says, you know, by God, when they tell us to go, we're going to go. They're going to get the drop on them and they and those, whether it be those poor people, those dark-skinned people, those people who don't speak English like Jesus wants us to in North America.
Right, because Jesus spoke English.
Absolutely.
English, right.
Yeah, yeah. Might have sounded like Henny Youngman. Who knows? I think there's a lot of funny lines in the New Testament if you look hard enough. But this cannot, this situation, Carol, and tell me if I'm wrong, cannot long endure.
Well, it is not a sustainable situation when, in my opinion, I'm standing in Ferguson going, where are all of these militia groups who complain about the jackbooted thugs of the government? And it's like, so you don't have a problem with over-policing and you don't have a problem with federal government when they're pointing guns at people you don't like. That's okay. So it just proved to me that all of those people who hung out in Nevada at the Bundy Ranch and run their mouths about don't tread on me and freedom and tyranny and government, you know, just shut up, because your absence in Missouri over the last 16 days has been, the silence is deafening from you people. It tells me everything that I need to know about how sincere you are about your beliefs.
Yeah, let's just do a quick check-in. Didn't see any Gadsden flags, I guess.
I didn't see a single Gadsden flag there.
No tricorn hats?
Not a one. Not a teabag hanging from anything.
No, you can have my gun when you pry it from my cold, dead fingers?
No, pretty much not. But
NRA registration booth?
No, but I will tell you that once they got the voter registration booth up, the head of the Missouri Republican Party said that it was disgusting.
Yes, yes. Well, go ahead.
And the problem with there not being a lot of people who vote in Ferguson, you have to remember how complicated this is with the disparity in the sentencing laws and the drug laws. You know, you have to think about how many people who live in those communities who have done time in jail who can't vote anymore. And yet the very same white counterparts who participated in the very same drug in another form got probation and didn't lose their voting rights. So, and I'm not saying that they all did, of course. And it was very gratifying Saturday. Our Secretary of State is a young Afghanistan veteran, and they were running out of voter registration forms. And he personally drove some up from Jefferson City to Ferguson, so that they could continue registering voters.
Well, that was my next question. Is there what you have written here is moving and powerful, an account of a young doctor, a man of color, who had a gun stuck pointed at him, a physician, for God's sakes.
And told to get a job.
And I'm presuming it was the cop who said get a job.
It was the cop who said, get a job.
You saw a lot of terrifying stuff and a pretty grim picture of America's past and present. Is there anything coming out of Ferguson, if there even should be, is there anything coming out of Ferguson that you found hopeful?
Yeah, there was a lot that I found hopeful. And it all resided within the sense of community and the spirit of those people who live in some very difficult conditions. these, an average of 3 warrants are served on every household in Ferguson. These, the police rely on, the city relies on getting income from figuring out ways that citizens have violated the law and making them pay. And so instead of, you know, obviously raising the tax base and attracting, you know, getting your economic developers in there to attract new business and doing community betterment, we just take it out of the hides of the people who are the least empowered to do anything about it. And yet these people, they stick together. And as I said, I wasn't treated badly. As a matter of fact, I was treated very well. I was fed. I was actually saved by an African American family the night of the riot when the tear gas went off. There was nowhere to go. And this lie that people were not tear gassed in their yards, I saw it with my own eyes. There were people standing in their yards. The police were screaming at them to get in the house. And they said, I live here. This is my yard. And they had tear gas canisters thrown at them. And I was standing right there and saw it. So when the police go to the media and they say that's absolutely not true, it absolutely is true, and I'm an eyewitness. So you have a community that is very, they are a very cohesive community. They all live in the same experience. They all have a sense of knowing that there's a certain way that they have to live in order to survive. They were not unwelcoming. They don't trust the media. And they did, once they realized that there was someone there to listen to them. And not necessarily to simply parrot back what they said in the way that they wanted to. I don't think that the piece that I wrote came off angry at all. I wanted it to come off as hopeful. I wanted it to come off as, I don't necessarily have the answers, but I found that listening goes a long way towards beginning. And that we all have to take responsibility for the situation, because I don't care if you're in Virginia. Everyone in Virginia has a responsibility to stand up and say that this is not right. Just as I look at the fracking and the strip mining, and while it's not necessarily happening in my neighborhood, I still sign the petitions and say that this is wrong, and I don't think that people should have their only drinking water sources poisoned, and I don't believe that rivers and streams should be poisoned, or, you know, I mean, we have to have environmental concerns for our neighbors, just as we have to have social justice concerns for people on another part of the country. Because someday, whether you like it or not, it will be you. Eventually, fracking is something that will be coming soon to a neighborhood near me.
Or they'll find something else under the ground that they want.
Well, tar sands is running. The tar sand pipeline is running through my county right now. And I'm a person who reads the paper every day, and I'm very aware of what's going on. And I'm told that there were public hearings on this, and yet none were announced in my community. I found out that they were announced about 3 counties away, where I wouldn't, of course, have ever gotten the notice of it. And they're just tearing through farmland like crazy, just not 10 miles from my house. And those pipelines leak. And once they do, that farmland is lost forever. So it is what it is. We are all dealing with something. We are all dealing with, we are a country in crisis, whether we like it or not. And we are all going to have to become a little bit more socially aware. And I'm not out to change the minds of the bigots. I'm not out to, those are the people that I'm never going to reach probably, but I wanted to talk to people who maybe hadn't really thought about it before. That's sort of the people that I wrote it for.
Oh, I hope it's getting good traffic. I have a question coming in from our buddy, the Angry Indian, Carol.
Yes.
He says, how are your social relationships within the greater white society? In other words, how do other white folks treat you when you point out their inherent xenophobia and apathy towards or even an awareness of concepts like white privilege, because you speak to white privilege pretty strongly in the article.
Well, I happen to live in an area where there are people who are living in pretty abject poverty, who are not highly educated, who do not understand that, well, we all, of course, have a certain sense of, we all have a certain responsibility for our lot in life to a point, but poverty, of course, is not a matter of people's willing to work. Poverty isn't about money. Poverty is a situation that is created. And it, just as poverty is created, poverty can be eradicated. But they don't necessarily understand that. I am not from here. I was originally from Northeast Iowa. I lived in Chicago for 12 years. I lived in New York City for 18 years. This was my summer home, and I decided to come and live here permanently. My community doesn't necessarily see me as one of them, of course. I am not to be trusted because I am an educated liberal.
You ain't from around here.
You ain't from around here. You ain't never been with that word before, which is my...
Yeah, it's kind of fair to note that you do refer to home these days as Hooterville.
Yes, I do. I do call it Hooterville because I don't want people to know where I live.
Right.
I'm not out to embarrass my neighbors. But
no.
But I do want to give people sort of a look at the microcosm of what it is that I live within. So do my neighbors understand me? No, they don't. Do they like me necessarily? Some of them like me very much. And they appreciate the fact that since I've been here, a community that did not even have a municipal water system now has a municipal water system.
That might come in handy, what with the pipelines and stuff coming through.
Exactly, because before everybody here had a cistern and used to have to truck their water in once a week.
I live in a very old house that had a cistern once upon a time, so I know a little bit about those.
Yeah, they're not fun. They're not fun when you run out of water. So.
Well, no. This thing, my grandparents put the cisterns in, and it was a two-layer gravity-fed kind of affair. My favorite thing as a child when we would visit back when we rode our dinosaur back from Alabama to West Virginia. It was a family-sized dinosaur. My favorite thing was to try to climb up on top of that cistern. And I worked year in and year out until I could pull myself up by arm strength to get up there.
Yes.
And, of course, my mother, being the overprotective soul that she was convinced that once I got atop the cistern that, it would cave in, or I would try to fly off, or, some sort of disaster would ensue. But we also had a well, and we still have a well. That well was drilled deeper than any other well in this community and had the freshest, most crystal clear, magnificent water you ever could hope to taste. And then they blew up the mountain about 3-4 miles out the road, and it turned red and started stinking like death, and we knew we ought not be drinking from it anymore.
Exactly.
So now we have city water.
Yes.
Which, of course, the one thing they never tell you is, congratulations, you have city water, you have fluoridation, fluoride in children's ice cream mandrake. But with that comes a bill.
Right.
That you pay forever.
Yes, exactly. But my answer to the angry Indian is I do not have these conversations with people in my community because they're not interested in having those conversations with me. When I first moved in was like during the first round of when Obama and Biden were running for president. And I had my Obama-Biden yard sign in my front yard, and I came home from work one day and my sign was destroyed, and someone had spray painted the word neighbor lover on the front of my house in red paint.
Oh, charming. We had our Obama Biden sign in the yard, and when our kids got on the bus, they beat him up and called him nigger lover.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it is what it is when you live in white, very, very white rural America. Let me ask you, Carol, first of all, you have been very, very generous with your time this evening, and I sincerely appreciate it. Tell people it's pretty obvious that you're very well spoken and your opinions are considered, and frankly you're much better at being funny when the topic is not so godforsaken grim. But tell people how they can access your work, hear you, read you, whatever.
Well, if you want to, I used to have my own radio show when through the Zeus Radio Network, and I ended that about a year ago. But I continue to write, and if you go to Hear Women Talk, www.hearewomentalk.com, if you go under op-ed, I am there under the opinionated bitch.
See?
And,
told you.
Yeah, absolutely. And which, and some of my articles are very funny, and some of them are very pointed, but I don't... And I will be honest with you, I have never in my life ever sat down in front of a computer and written something where I cried from beginning to end as I was writing it.
Only this time I did, because
I was so sad for my country. And when I was done, I felt hopeful. And people who have read it have written to me and said, I just felt so quiet when I was done.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you that I got more value, if that's even the right word, I got more value out of what you wrote than a telephone book-sized stacks worth of reporting from what I refer to as the for-profit media in the last 2 weeks. And I'm not blowing smoke at you. That's a fact.
It's not that long a read, and it's entitled Especially When It Rains. And it was taken from something that Michael Brown's mother said. She was being interviewed with Trayvon Martin's mother and some other mothers who had lost their sons to gun violence. And, you know, the reporters have a tendency to ask some very stupid and inane questions. And this one I thought was interesting. He said, do you ever talk to your son when you're alone? And she just kind of stared off into nothingness, and a tear just started to roll down her face, and it wasn't like a whacking sobbing. It was one of those just, I can't stop crying tears. And she just kind of said real softly, she goes, yeah, especially when it rains. I was so quieted by that comment because I thought there were always going to be triggers for this woman, but when she said it, and it was the way that she said it, and I wanted to be able to, for people who haven't seen the interview, I wanted to be able to capture that moment in a way and to bring it around and to make them understand what it was she was really trying to say, because I got it. It wasn't about her just talking to her son when it rains. There was more. And so... I am so glad you enjoyed it, and you don't know how grateful I am that you invited me here to talk to you about my experience. And if anyone ever gets a chance to go see Social Justice in Action for themselves, do it very carefully, the way that I did, and I was very careful. But my advice to anyone is to go in there with an open mind. Don't talk, just listen. Just listen. Because what you get is a gift.
Hear, hear. Carol Baker, thank you very much. One last thing. Where can folks find you on social media?
Well, I've got my Facebook page tightened down pretty tight because of the stalkers. I do have a tendency to throw firebombs. But
no.
I have a fan page on Facebook.
Oh, yay.
The Opinionated Bitch has her own fan page. And... so you can find me there, and it is under Carol Baker, but my avatar says grab a pitchfork and a flaming torch. It's a yellow avatar.
Yes.
So you'll know that it's me.
Okay.
I have a common name, so I thought it would be easier for them to find me that way.
Do you, you seem to tweet pretty a good bit, too.
I do. My Twitter handle is @Mo, M-O, Waterhouse. And that was a nod to where I live on a lake in Missouri. It's at the lake, the Waterhouse.
At the Missouri Water. Got it.
Okay. At Mo Waterhouse. That's what that's about.
Well, you know what? You're welcome. You're welcome here anytime the spirit moves you.
Bless your heart.
And I thank you for the great joy I get in reading you. and the exchanges and everything. It's a real pleasure to finally talk to you. And well, maybe the next time we'll cuss and discuss a little bit more broadly.
Listen, I would love to come back and cuss and discuss. I have the vocabulary of a well-educated sailor.
Carol, thank you so much. Have a wonderful evening.
You too, and thanks for having me.
Good night, pleasure. Bye now.
Bye.
Carol Baker over at Hear Women Talk, HEREWOMENTALK.com, The Opinionated Bitch. And this particular essay is well worth your time. I would even encourage you, what's even mean? I would encourage you not just to read it, but to share it. Share it broadly. Share it widely. This piece needs to go viral. It sincerely does. And I hope it will. And if it does go viral, I hope it will do so by way of real, honest to God, not kidding, consciousness raising. Because this is a consciousness raising piece. Especially when it rains, Carol Baker, hearwomentalk.com. We are we have crossed over into the second hour of the program this evening. You know, of course, that I don't do a lot of so-called guests on the program. I'm sorry. Let's see. Sparky says, link, please, Bob. Here we go. Multitasking. So we've gone over into the second hour of the program. It's 17 minutes past the hour. We'll take a little break. This is Tuesday, right? Yeah, Tuesday, the 26th of August. Hey, where's Brad and Desi this evening? Well, I'll see if I can find out. We'll take a break and come back to your calls, your observations, if you are so inclined. You know the number, 304-574-8178, 304-574-8178. If you just want to reach out Skype to Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N is the Skype handle, and just send me a contact request, and we'll be hooked up and rocking and rolling in no time. Email also comes into bobkincaid@gmail.com, and you are... welcome to participate via email as well. We'll take a break and get back to the business and get on with the business. Not back to, because the very heart and soul of conversation radio has just been on display for the last hour and 18 minutes. No commercial interruptions. Nothing of the sort. And that's what we do here. We do it because you make it possible to continue to do it. I want to send out thanks to Sal, who is right there evening in, evening out, and often is the first to get us started on any given evening's fundraising. That is the case this evening. Sal was the first to get us started. Thank you very much, Sal. So a little break, and then we'll come back and get after it some more. Conversation Radio. Head on RadioNetwork.com. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Thank you.
Red rain coming down. Red rain coming down over me and the red sea over me. Over me. Red rain.
24 minutes past the hour, Peter Gabriel, Red Rain. This is the Horn for Titanic Tuesday, and we will get to some of that Titanic right-wing intellect at some point in time, I suspect. But let us go straightway to the Skype line. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Yes.
Yes, Bob. This is the Happy Hippie Billy.
That's what I thought, the Happy Hippie Billy.
Yeah. You can just call me Happy.
Okay, Happy.
It's kind of hard these days.
I can trip over that real easy, so yeah, we'll stick with Happy.
Yeah, great call, Carol. Thank you for your time. That was a 45-year-old man here with tears in his eyes.
The essay did the same thing to me last night, so
yeah.
don't feel like you're alone or anything.
Oh no, I don't think I'm alone at all. In fact, it feels good to the thing she said that just really struck home was I don't want to get unangry or. I don't know how she said it, but I don't want to forget. We can't. When it comes right down to it, we're so messed up. Everything is it's hard to stay happy. I've noticed in the last couple of weeks, Bubba, you have turned it up. Your show is, or, sorry, not show, your program. Fantastic work.
Thank you.
I guarantee, I don't know how many people you have listening to you, but I'm sure there's a, I'm sure half of them are bobbing their heads in agreement. You have turned it up, and it's just great to be a part of it. And thank you for all you do.
Well, that is mighty kind of you to say, and it is humbling. It is humbling to hear. I know I say that a good bit, but I can't get in here behind this microphone every night and pretend that I have talent on loan from God and half my brain tied behind my back. I can't spare it, but it's like what Carol was talking about, this idea of community. I take it very seriously. Dr. Bill was talking about community earlier today, and how and the fact that James Madison and the framers of the Constitution were absolutely convinced that if this country did not get really, really down deep into the idea of getting the entire nation involved in ideas of community, that we're toast. Look where it's gotten us. We got away from it, and this is what happens when you do.
Yeah, they run in cycles. They do run in cycles. I'm not I'm not the smartest guy, and I haven't been around that long. But history is repeating itself over and over. It just seems like it's getting shorter and shorter and more compressed, to where these cycles are. I mean, friends of mine that are in their 20s are seeing it. And then it's becoming very, it's weird. It's just weird. You talk about saving things and it's like, I don't think it's possible. I really don't. We're just a couple of Katrinas away from spinning something in another direction, and we're supposed to get dozens of those over the next 10 years.
Oddly enough, I was just looking at something that was my attention was directed to over on Facebook, Happy. I have just seen the 2014-2015 early winter forecast. I really don't like this map.
No. And it's just going to get worse.
Well, where I'm sitting is in a band that is labeled well below average temperatures and average to above average snowfall precipitation.
You got a wood stove?
No.
Get a wood stove. Please get a wood stove.
I've actually contemplated it, Happy, but I'm afraid I would burn the house down. I mean, this thing is old.
Well, you know best. We're up here in Washington. In fact, just right across the river from Oregon. We're in the southern part of Vancouver.
Well, this map says you can expect well above average temperatures and very dry.
Yeah, that's
not good news for you.
No, no, not at all. We're green for a reason. We don't go green. Sparky can tell you. We don't go green. Everybody gets itchy. Yep. You know, and we live in, I live in a city where it's not really affected, but me and my sweetheart, we're looking to move north up where it's a little greener and a little less dense because there's a lot of people around here. And, not that people are bad. It's just that, you know, it's a lot of people around here.
Yeah.
And if something did go bad.
Dense as in dense as in closely packed, not particularly unenlightened, right?
Yeah, it's yeah, exactly. Well, no, we got some of that too, actually.
Well,
but yeah, not much you do about that. No, just the weather. That's when you think about it, everything's just a powder keg anyway. A house of cards. There's so many things. Quite honestly, I read something the other day. 10 years. It would take 10 years to recover from the solar flare that missed us 2 weeks. 2 weeks later, or yeah, I think it was 2 weeks later, and the solar flare, the largest one ever recorded or something close to it, would have just impaled us. And they say 10 years, I mean, no more horn. No, we wouldn't even know. We'd wake up, our cars wouldn't work, and our radios, the radios might work depending on what kind of radio you have, but the cable, satellite, all that gone.
Are you familiar with that old Twilight Zone episode, The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street?
Unfortunately, no.
It's worth looking up because it's the situation you're describing. Because you know, when you said happy, we'll wake up one morning and you know the car won't work, there won't be any information, internet's down, power's out. I don't think the American people are nearly the stalwart, sturdy pioneer stock that the teabaggers and the birchers and libertarians and booger eaters would have us believe. I think we'd probably freak out in a pretty big hurry.
Oh, we'd be wetting ourselves quick.
Yeah. Did the Chinese do this to us? Maybe we'd better nuke them now.
Yeah. I would hope that the people that have control of the button would know. I mean, I would assume that they're the most informed. But just a common person. And, you know, not to get all, Alex Jonestown on you or anything and try to strike fear. But, it's tough as it is. It's just tough being alive and we keep putting these veils, these different levels that keep skewing everything. And quite honestly, we are back in the times when our relatives or early relatives, our ancestors were just surviving. It's different now. You know, somebody mentioned yesterday, we don't assassinate presidents with bullets. We do it with the press or something like that. And well, the same goes for us. You know, we're so close to having something get pulled out from underneath us that it doesn't, we become dependent on things. And, you know, like I said, I'm not trying to, not to sound, you know, all alarmist or anything, but we really do have to focus our concentration and it's never going to happen. It really isn't. We're being sent back to this, if it isn't clear already, we're being sent back to a time when we need to rely on our neighbor. We need to create a community and I'm glad we have the horn. I hope we can find a way. But even we right now, as we're talking, all this technology is, it's not advancement. It's put us behind, because if one solar flare can knock out communication, if a bad storm can disrupt the infrastructure to the point where we don't have power, people start dying. You know, and then we're not sitting, you know, I have the luxury of having a wood stove if there's a problem. You know, but how many people aren't? And how quick would it turn? And we're gonna count on this dysfunctional, you know, this dysfunctional government. And I mean, like, using that term, because what is government, damn it? We're supposed to be the government. You know, the government is you and me.
Yeah, that's the theory.
Yeah, it's well, there you struck upon it. There's a lot of theories. And until they're put to practice, they just stay theories. And maybe we just never got to practice it.
Well, the problem
is, I know, not in my lifetime.
The problem is we have certainly put into practice the theories of the right wing, which have proven to be an unmitigated disaster.
Now, when you say right wing, I'm just curious, without putting you on the spot, what does that mean to you? What is right wing? Is that a? I mean, I'm assuming a lot of people associate. I mean, word salad these days messes us up. Most people assume that is Republican, but that doesn't even have to be Republican, does it?
Well, no. In fact, I view the political continuum as a circle and not a line. Because
explain that, please.
Well, because if you move far enough to the so-called left, you will find people who could sit down and have coffee with the furthest end of the so-called right, and they're, you know, and basically the line has been bent into a circle.
I get you. I agree. I agree.
But to answer your question, what do I mean by the right wing? I'm talking about authoritarians. I'm talking about people who run around hollering about how they want a small government. And about how we're all just free, liberty loving individuals who don't need no government out there to because that'll take away our freedom. What the right wing are in this country now, Happy, is a bunch of fascist oriented anarchists.
Yeah.
I mean, does that make any sense to you?
Yes, it does. It does. It's funny that you say anarchist, because the reason you got me. I've been trying to be a lurker. I've been trying to just mind my own business and just observe, and be the quiet guy in the room.
No, sooner or later, you will succumb to the urge to converse.
Yeah, with you and the horn, I agree, because it took this. It took me a year and a half. I've been listening to you for about a year and a half. Actually, thank Will Romney. Because of him and shutting down the only liberal radio station that my radio could pick up, he shut it down. I started listening to Mike Malloy online, and just one night, for some reason, it stayed on, and this guy came on and was giving me a history lesson, and I got hooked ever since. Yeah.
Thank heaven for small favors.
Yeah, thank you, Will.
Yeah.
But
that's Bishop Willard to you, by God.
You got it. You know, yeah, you got it. But I lost my thought. I have a tendency. I got that ADD thing. But what were we talking about?
we were talking about what the right wing means and what it means in practical application, and what it means in practical application is when with the triumph of the right wing in this country. You get Ferguson. With the triumph of the right wing in this country, you get fire departments that watch houses burn down.
It's a punishment thing. They love to punish.
Oh, well, you get the prison industrial complex.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, the difference in the number of people who were incarcerated in the United States in, say, 1974 versus the number who were incarcerated in 2014, 40 years later, a generation later, is not made up for by the increase in overall national population. This has been a drive to incarcerate, and as I think Carol alluded to, and we probably should have explored in greater depth, in the Jim Crow South, and, you know, Missouri gets kind of included in that, they were overt, and they said, you ain't a-gonna vote, because you might upset our apple cart. So when the federal government passed the Voting Rights Act, you know, we the people, the right wing had to move into crisis response mode, because the right wing can never succeed in this country in huge turnout elections. This is borne out statistically time after time after time. Every presidential election, the Republican Party prays for rain, snow, rivers of blood, locusts, frogs, whatever it takes to keep people from going to the ballot box, going to the polls, because they've got to suppress voting in order to win elections, at least on a national basis. So what you get, Sparky pointing out in the chat room, three strikes laws, that's another manifestation of it. But in particular, with regard to voting, what Carol said about Ferguson is very much cross-applicable to a number of communities. What do you do if you've got a bunch of people that you don't want voting, that you cannot legally prevent from voting at the polls? Well, arrest them, charge them with felonies, and that way you take away their right to vote fair and square now, don't you?
Oh, of course. Of course. And you know, anybody with half a brain would see that. In fact, we need more people connecting dots. And I say that, just part of me, just a very small sliver of me says that, because the bigger part of me tells me that that's a waste of time. No offense to anybody who's, you know, who's doing it. You know, thank you, but really, what good is it going to do? What good is it going to do? I would think that it's kind of obvious at this point that the scale's tipped. You know, I mean, it's bad enough that we have to survive the way we survive with all of this made up garbage that keeps getting thrown at us. This, I mean, I call them veils, but I mean, all these different veils. You've got religion, you've got governments, you've got ideologies that come from them and cultures that come from them, and all of this, you can't even see through it. It's like looking through 20 layers of Visqueen. And on the other side is the real threat, which is coming, which is, at this point, it's the environment. And of all the other things, and it's not like I'm some tree hugger, although I do.
Let's just get real. Hugging trees is fun. It's
nice.
It is.
It feels good, and I recommend everybody do it.
And I know it may sound crazy. The tree hugs back.
It does. It's in your head, and that's important. As long as you can recognize that, that's in your head. But it is what hey, we share the same gases back and forth.
Yeah. I read this fascinating article out of some scientific publication a couple of weeks ago that, you know, because I talk about how anthropocentric I am and anthropophilic, you know, I'm all about the human species on planet Earth. This article actually caused me to start rethinking that, Happy, because what it was talking about was, okay, so you're a little younger than me, but you remember back in the 70s when they started talking about how, lo and behold, if you talk to your house plants, the house plants respond?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I remember that.
Okay.
I do it to this day.
So so what happens, according to this research, and I'm sure I'm going to screw this up, but underneath the ground, within the root system, there are, you know, the root system of a tree can go far and wide. By God, I spent my childhood mowing around root systems near the surface of the earth, and you know, I ruined a few mowers. So yeah, they get around there. I feel bad about it now, really. But the root systems, some scientists are beginning to think, actually communicate, and it's almost the way I read the article, or the way I perceived the article. It sounded almost as though they were describing neural pathways.
That wouldn't surprise me at all.
And so the oaks are the oaks are talking to the pines, and the pines are talking to the birches, and the birches are talking to the canebrake, and on and on and on like that. Wouldn't it? And maybe I'm predisposed toward thinking this. You know, I'm not a religious guy, but that doesn't mean I can't feel pretty good about about the notion that the whole planet is alive,
and I agree.
And that just because we think that, just because we insist anthropocentrically on the right to define what is life, it ain't necessarily so.
Yeah, or what communication means.
Well, precisely.
Yeah, you I think it was I get the names wrong, but there was a lady who called in who wanted to talk about her cherry blossom tree.
Oh, that was Captain Mary.
Okay, and I heard it in your voice. You kind of walked back on it because you didn't want to. It was kind of awkward for you to say, yeah, it was talking to me, but it is talking to you. It's in your head. You are the host of your own show. And everything you see and everything you think of, whether it's going on or not, is in your head. It's your perception. Your perception is 100% always, always correct. You know, how you see something is correct. How you perceive it is how, you know, you may take it from there and go in another direction and start applying veils, if you wish, to cloud that view so that you end up sounding like a goofball. But But I heard you almost kind of go, I don't know. And it's like, yeah, well, I think so. And that tree was talking to you. That's your experience. And I think it would not surprise me just because, hey, are chimpanzees stupid because they don't speak English? Are dolphins dumb because they don't speak Russian?
See, I've referenced that before, that there's a classic Gary Larson Far Side cartoon. And there are some dolphins in a tank in a laboratory with their little bottle noses sticking up out of the water. And the scientists are looking at each other, and one of them says, I don't know, they just keep making these habla español noises.
That's funny. Yeah, but that in a nutshell. Now, dolphins to humans, but it happens humans to human. We have I don't know if it's a curse or blessing. Sometimes the language, I've been told that the English language is one of the most complex as far as how many words. And, that kind of, I mean, I may be wrong there, but, it's gotta be up there. I'll tell you this, it's one of the most deceptive languages. So many words that you can use so many ways so that you can keep so many people confused. And then you can always fall back and say, well, that's what I said. But what did you say? What were you saying? I heard what you were talking. I heard the words, but really, what were you saying? You know, we the internet's a perfect example. How many times we read something or you're texted and you think,
how many times do we get upset about something because so much of human communication is done via tone of voice
or
a wink or a smile or a frown. I mean, that's why emoticons developed early on in the process of internet-based communication.
Exactly.
Asshole is a different word from asshole, winking, smiley face.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And if the person doesn't really know who you are, I mean, I don't even have to put those little icons and those little, what do you call them?
Emoticons?
Emoticons. Yeah, yeah. There's little smiles, a thumbs up, that kind of stuff. I don't use them, but I've seen them. I don't even have to use those with my best friends. I could say the rankest things, and they will laugh and they will chuckle because they know, oh, that's Damon. Or you didn't hear that. That's Happy. Blah, blah, blah. That's Happy.
Don't worry. We'll take that out on the cutting room floor.
Sure, I bet. But, the way it works is that the whole thing is made to deceive. And it's built upon to deceive, and it's really hard to keep up. And I consider myself, you know, a pretty in tune guy, and I can barely even keep up. I look at all these people that are just mindlessly, and I don't mean anything mean. I think they're beautiful people. They need, you know, I hear all these words that people use for people, and how they lump everybody into these little chimpanzee and dolphin categories, and it's like, no, they're people, and we try to deceive them, and we try to, it's almost like this culture.
Who was the father of taxonomy?
You got me there.
Oh, doggone it! At any other moment, I would have been able to answer the question, but you know that was a product of, and it goes all the way back to Aristotle trying to pigeonhole things into discrete line. Carolus Linnaeus, thank you.
Okay.
I'll buy my mind a beer in a minute, and then I won't have to worry about Carolus Linnaeus again. But no, it's a human urge, but maybe it's a wrong urge. Maybe instead of coming up with lists of, well, at the end of the day, we're, at least the scientists tell us that we all go back to the origin of life on Earth, and that origin is a single-celled organism.
Yeah.
So why isn't our nearest relative the amoeba instead of our nearest relative is the chimpanzee? I mean, for God's sakes, we share, what, in excess of 90% of our DNA with freaking frogs? Don't we?
Yeah, no kidding. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and then our blood is one little something or other off from grass. I mean, it's no surprise. I mean, I use the word non-theist. I really, the atheist movement, I can't get behind the cult mentality. I really have a tough, I was raised in one. Broke free around 26 years old. And so I got a late start in life when it comes to free thinking. And the inertia took 10 years to finally snap out of it to where you can start thinking clearly. And here I am my late 30s finally starting to see it. And I have this aversion to cults, and I view that, but a non-theist sounds good to me. And so that's the term I use. And it doesn't take much for somebody to realize how simple it really is, yet we want to complicate it. And we want to complicate it. Why? I don't want to complicate it. You don't want to complicate it. We want to keep it simple. Boil it down. One sentence. Don't hurt someone. Pretty easy. Pretty easy. But yet, oh no, don't hurt someone unless they have a turban on their head. And don't hate somebody unless they speak a weird language. And all these veils, I keep going back to that. I'm sorry. I wish I had a broader vocabulary, but all these layers that just keep getting thrown onto us.
Well, I don't think that's a bad word. There are layers of perceived reality. It's like that Kurt Vonnegut quote that I use with all of my emails. That, I'm going to have to call it up now. A normal person functioning well on the upper levels of a prosperous industrialized society can hardly hear his conscience at all. Now, if we break that sentence down, there are veils in there. It presumes a normal person. It presumes that the normal person is functioning well. That's the second layer. Okay, no. Person, first layer. Normal, two. Functioning, three. Functioning well, four. On levels, five, upper, six, of a society, seven, that is prosperous, eight, industrialized, nine, can hardly hear his conscience at all. Well, you know, you try listening in on a conversation through nine layers of blanket.
Yeah, you got it. You got it. We overcomplicate. So we overcomplicate everything. And it's by design, and it's not some cabal that does it. It's just learned behavior, and well, that works. Let's just do it. Oh, by the way, we got to try it this way now, and oh, that one even works better. Let's combine the two, and the next thing you know, everybody's lost, and that's on purpose. The worst thing you can do to the masses is educate them. Why do you think that they've been destroying our education system for what now, 30 years?
Longer than that.
Oh, I'm sure the Romans, white bread, take the nutrients out, give them a gut ache, and show them the circus. If we aren't there again, you know, and I hate to use those analogies. In fact, here comes your obligatory Nazi one, if you don't mind.
Oh, go ahead. We haven't had a good Nazi reference in a while.
If you and I were of Jewish descent, neighbors in Germany back in the 30s, at what point would we say, time to go? It's time to go. I mean, we could never foresee what was going to happen, but I would think somewhere along the line, the educator would go, time to go. And I'm not saying leave the country. I'm not saying, I mean, where are you going to go? I mean, the U.S., and it's not even, I have a problem with that even, because what is a government? What are these lines in the sand we've drawn? Well, what is it? I mean, it's more of the veils.
Well, again, you know? Again, because everything is some sort of a one-liner to me, I guess.
Keep it simple. That's why.
Well, in a way, I try use these things to try to pass on a certain degree of perceptiveness to our kids here. There's the story about the two little fishes swimming along in the ocean one day, young fishes, and the old fish swims by and looks at the two young fishes and says, "Water feels nice this morning." And as after he's gone by, the two young fishes look at each other and say, "What's this water he's talking about?"
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There's a world around you, and you either choose to be in it and aware of it, or to try to ignore it, or just
be deceived into not looking,
or to be deceived into thinking that it's something else.
And when there is a layer like money, or a veil like an economy, there's a natural tendency to be greedy, especially in some, not all. In fact, I know some beautiful people that don't even want to worry about money. They want to go into a place where there is no money, but when that element is involved, now you have motivation to deceive, motivation to tear people away. And we sit around and we can talk about them. In fact, some of the most intelligent people that I've listened to in the last couple years have been on this program. And from them, I'm able to gut check and make sure that I'm where I'm supposed to be, where I'm happy. But what are some of these people, what are we doing? I mean, what can we do? We're a solar flare away, brother. And I don't want to get political, but who knows? And everybody puts all this emphasis on the president. The president's nothing. He's a puppet. In fact, everybody's a puppet. I mean, and it's not like some cabal. I'm not some conspiracy theorist. It's a beast that just gets out of control.
But you're right. We're one solar flare away. We are one super volcano eruption away. We are one earthquake at San Onofre or any of the other nuclear power plants. We're one something away from disaster, and that's why I've constantly said that most people, and maybe it's because we can't function on this degree of awareness. We're one something away from disaster all the time. One hurricane, one derecho. You know, you mentioned the power going out.
Oh yeah.
And maybe I sound like I overplay it, but you know what? I have never been afraid in all my life of that sort of thing. I grew up with tornadoes and weather events and everything, but there was always underlying it the notion that while there might be some inconvenience or, God forbid, horrible injuries or even death, that ultimately the social structure that underpinned it all would pick up the pieces and move on. I cannot say in 2014 that any longer is the case in the United States.
It isn't. And quite honestly, let's not sugarcoat it. This future that we have talked about, that I've heard you for, well, of course, I already been aware of it. I mean, my reality, my perception. So I don't speak for everybody. But I've known for quite a while. But this, especially Malloy, because I listened to Malloy, 5-6 years ago, for a while. We hear that the fascism is taking over and things are tipping, and one of these days, we're there. Go talk to people in Ferguson. I don't mean to insult you. You know, guess what? That just happened.
Ferguson.
They don't need a derecho. They don't need a storm. And that's man-made.
Yeah, and the warning that is out there, Happy, for the rest of America from Ferguson, is that it can happen here.
Oh,
okay.
It is happening here. It may not make the news, but I have friends that are profiled. I have friends. I mean, that gentleman down in Beverly Hills, you mentioned yesterday. It happened to him. That's Beverly Hills. And you know what? We shouldn't be surprised. We shouldn't put labels like Beverly Hills or Harlem or the East Side or the West Side or the Upper Hills or the Valley. It's happening everywhere. It's just a matter of how much they can keep it down, and they want to keep it down. They know, I don't think it was you that I heard this from, but somebody mentioned about the story from the Greeks that the one Greek was really upset because he bumped into a slave on the street and said, "I accidentally talked to a slave. I didn't realize he was a slave." And he was telling his friend, and his friend came back. He goes, "We should have everybody, all the slaves need to wear yellow so that we can see who they are so we can avoid them." And the wiser and older Greek said, no, if everybody sees that everybody's wearing yellow, we're in trouble. And you see, they want to keep everybody dumb. You can't stop this. The only way you can stop it, and again, we have so many other things coming at us now that are a direct result of this been running rampant for years. The only way we can stop it is to negate, a good start, to negate money. We can't. I know, I mean, the first thing is, how am I gonna, they did just said sometime, maybe we have gone too far. But I tell you what, everybody in my, within the sound of my voice that can hear this, I shut my television off back in 2007. The last show I watched was South Park spoof on the inauguration, or not the inauguration, the acceptance speech of Barack Obama to be president. After that show, and not because of that show, and not because of, just because I decided to, I haven't watched one television program. And you talk about personal growth. Everybody save that $100. Save that $100. Shut that crap off. Get your news where you're going. Search. And I think I'm talking to the choir now, because anybody who's listening to this, but you know what? Go one step further. Go find people to listen to this. Find people to research this and get involved in this. You know, send your $5. That's great. In fact, if everybody shut off their damn television and sent the horn half the money, we could get that 6-hour program you've been dreaming about. We really could, because we're sending that money to where? Where are we sending that to? So that we can be told what to wear, how to dress, and have some fodder. I've been off of the system for almost 6 years now, and I tell you, bro, my mind is just, it's not cluttered. And you're able to think. And there's something about television versus radio. When you have to form the picture in your head, it's less, it's real. It's not, you can take a picture and you can take a sound bite and you can take those things and tweak them and stir up emotion and gear people
in
a direction.
You're self-processing instead of having something handed to you.
Thank you. And the internet is the same thing. Instead of television, go to the internet. You can actually interact and decide what you want to learn.
And you know what? There are lessons to be learned in the internet that extend beyond choosing which information one wants, because if the internet becomes nothing more than an exercise in confirmation bias, then it's not doing much different from what cable was doing, save for the fact that you're choosing which biases to get confirmed instead of letting a corporate executive choose which biases get confirmed. But you got it will, if you're very serious about it, it will make a critical thinker out of you.
For instance,
last night, and I'm telling a story on myself. Last night, I got snookered. A story went around from, and I saw it posted on Facebook from somebody who is usually pretty solid. And I read it, and, you know, I've developed a pretty sharp eye for satire and parody. And in this case, there was nothing in the story that spoke to satire. There was nothing, you know, there wasn't a funny name. There wasn't a goof, you know, there was nothing goofy in it. You know, if you go to The Onion, The Onion will give itself away even if you don't know it's The Onion.
Oh, yeah, they know what they're doing.
Unless it's, you know, some teabagger or Chinese state media. But even in the case of the latter, it's excusable because, you know, the translational barrier. But anyway, none of that was there. There was nothing parody-like, there was nothing satire-like, and it was a horrifying story. And I posted it. And a few minutes later, one of the listeners, I think it was Kevin, posted and said, I'm not sure. And so, lo and behold, I went and, yeah, it was... This story in the context of the current situation, the current climate in the United States, had been deliberately falsely created in order to generate fake outrage. I almost wondered if it was a case of Facebook deliberately manipulating feelings, like they have admitted to have done in a psychological study of the users. So, you know, having gotten snookered, I'm a little bit wiser. And I went back to my page and I took it down and I deleted it and suggested, and I informed the person I had gotten it from and said, you know, warning, Will Robinson. But it will make you a closer reader. If you, you know, if, for instance, if you were to have read the smear article that the New York Times ran on Michael Brown yesterday on the day he was being buried. you walk away saying, A, that ain't funny, B, that ain't right, and C, who in God's name would be willing to pay for this?
And, wait, what's that?
In many instances, the New York Times is similar to the cable. You can turn them off, too. I mean, my God, there was a column by Maureen Dowd that took the Gettysburg Address and turned it into a critique of Barack Obama for having the nerve to play golf. And while
I see what you're saying, and there is no answer to that. There is no answer to that. I'm a believer that the internet is not going to be the way the internet is now. I think that it is I think what you're seeing when you see all that, and I guess it comes down to people again, because if you go in looking for the truth, then your mind is clear and you will look at everything and then you use reason and you fall upon examples that you've seen and you start looking. When you go in trying to make your case or try to prove a truth, that's not truth. In fact, there's not that much truth.
Well, I think we have already seen the full flower of the wide open internet. That day is gone.
I agree. I think now you're seeing a bunch of, I do agree with you. I think that for confirmation bias, there's a lot of garbage out there that will just keep feeding it, and they finally caught hip, and there are certain places that you can go to. I mean, I suggest anybody who has, I'm sure you know about Reddit. Anybody who hasn't looked up reddit.com, fantastic. That's where I get my news, because you find people that are of like minds of you. And when I say like minds, not trying to confirm things as much as people that I love to have conversations with people that can have them sanely, of course, and give me things that I've never thought of, because it strengthens you. In fact, if anything, I come away from it being more convicted towards my thoughts, because and not in a hostile way, as much as, okay, I was able to hear something different. No, that doesn't make sense to me. And I broke it down and I tried to know I'm moving forward. This is fantastic. And you become a better person. When you're sitting down waiting for the news to tell you what you want to hear, how much crap are you listening in between? A shit sandwich. I mean, you get your nugget and you wait 15 minutes, you get your other little nugget and you try to put it together, and halfway through you've been programmed about what soap to buy, who said what, and another lie. It's just all over the place. And so you could do those same two points within seconds on the internet, but I don't believe that it's going to be around much longer, quite honestly. I think it's going to have an internet problem.
No, I think it'll be around. I don't think the world is going to let it go. I think one of the questions you're asking, Happy, is whether the United States can maintain its portion of the infrastructure.
Well, more important. Yeah, okay, I'll give you that. Yeah, and I don't mean to be how centrist or how. Yeah, the United States is not the center of the universe. That's a tough one to I have to constantly remind myself that, because I don't have too many friends outside the country. So, you know, the majority of, although I do a lot of research and read, but the infrastructure is one thing, but more importantly, I think the internet is going to be going through some changes that especially here. Yeah, and it may not even be infrastructural. I think it's going to be, gateways are going to be closed. And things are, I mean, it's happened. I mean, it's been happening. I believe it's been happening. I think things are shut down. I've gone looking for things that I know I read. I know I had, and I didn't bookmark it. And I remember keywords, and you go back in there and try to find it, and you can't find it. If it gets lost, it gets lost. You know, and not to sound, you know, again, I'm not going.
Well, and stuff comes and goes. I mean, one of the essential problems, and it's actually something that I think about, Happy, is that everything, everything of especially like with a small organization like the Horn, a small effort. All of the archives are on a server that gets paid for on a month-to-month basis. And if the bill don't get paid, there's 10, you know, there's 10 years worth of audio that just goes gone.
Yeah.
And so you know, that's not to say it's not backed up or anything, but if you want something to be, well, what you're running up against is the idea of the capacity of the internet to host exponentially increasing amounts of data. And the question arises, and I don't have the answer because I'm not a computer genius, I'm not any kind of genius at all. But the question arises is the internet infinite?
That's a good question. Yeah, I couldn't answer that. I'm amazed at what we're able to accomplish with it. I think it's an amazing tool. I guess what I'm saying that if it did, we've become so dependent upon it for everything. And although it should, I try to look at it as a luxury. If I did wake up tomorrow and there was a solar flare, I would be okay. I can't say that for everybody. I know that's not the case for everybody. In fact, the majority it's not. And it's not like I'm some survivalist living up in the woods, but, you know, I would be okay with that. I got rid of my phone 2 years ago. I haven't had a cell phone in 2 years. Let me tell you something, brother. That is freedom. To be able to come home and only communicate through your email so that you're not constantly bombarded with phone calls is wonderful. And I know not everybody can do that, but I'm the kind of guy that I'd be fine if I found out that nothing was working tomorrow. Because I've gone without it for so long.
And as long as you were sufficiently provisioned to get through whatever it was. And,
yeah.
And this is not the part of the program where we start selling freeze-dried food or anything.
Of course not.
But the thing is, I mean, just from a practical, real-world perspective, you know, you've mentioned solar flares, I mentioned earthquakes, supervolcanoes. But the fact of the matter is, this country is teetering and tottering and galumphing along on spit and bailing, spit toilet paper and bailing wire, okay?
I think the world is.
Well, no, some parts of the world are better at it than others. Germany measures its electricity outages per year in minutes. We measure ours in the United States in days.
Yeah.
Okay. And what happens? And you actually have to sit down and have some presence of mind and think about this stuff. When in consideration of what kind of life we lead. When we always have, for instance, around here, more so now than previously, but we've always got 10 or 15 gallons of bottled water. Okay?
Smart.
We've always got bags of dry beans and bags of rice and dried fruit. It's not much of a diet, you know, and we've got, you know, raisins and nuts and things like that. I try to make sure they're always here. And there's always a few of those little one-pound canisters of propane to run a Coleman camp stove. And all of these are, and there's always five, you know, at least 5 and usually 10 gallons of gasoline to run a generator. Because starting, I got a really, really hard lesson in 2012 about how absolutely necessary those things are. The derecho that hit, and people are sick of hearing me talk about it, I'm sure. But it was a turning point here. And 1 year and 3 months to the day, after the derecho, we were out of power for another week when we got the blizzard side of Sandy. And when I talk about a teetering, tottering infrastructure, I'm not exaggerating. The electricity infrastructure in this state is hung on toothpicks that run up and down mountains, for all intents and purposes. And
one good wind and it's gone. Yeah.
Well, and not just that. It's not even one good wind. You know, we come to dread the winter not because I hate winter, but because I know what it means. So, for instance, the power companies, because you know you got to serve those shareholders happy. You got to keep the quarterly profit and loss statement in order, or the shareholders will not be thrilled, and then maybe the CEO won't be able to buy a gold plated shower curtain. Okay, so you scrimp on infrastructure in order to pay share dividends, and consequently you've got power lines that run through. You know, this is with everything that's been done to Appalachia. There's still a lot of forest land here, and we got power lines that run through forests, and we got forests that come right up to the edge of the road, and a power company that won't maintain its right of way. So In the harsh dead of winter, say an ice storm comes, and then 4 or 5 inches of snow fall on top of that. Well, the trees start snapping, they land on a power line, and the next thing you know, that happens, you know, 100 times over, and 100,000 people are without electricity.
Oh yeah. Meanwhile, 51% or so I've been told of our budget is going over to bomb and build other things. And you know what, we should be one global community when it comes to helping each other. It's disgusting and we have to blow it up to rebuild it. That we could probably do without that part. But the amount of money, I mean, when I emailed you yesterday and said, me too, nothing rings clearer than when, was it Bill, is that his name, from Montana?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I got tears in my eyes because it's like, we are at the point where we have to take care of ourselves. We really do. And I don't want to be, and I'm not into titles. So my choice isn't libertarian. If you are of the mindset where you have to give yourself a title to decide what you're going to do with your life, oh boy, please don't go down that road. I'm who I am. You are who you are. And let's quit giving these stupid titles so that we can decide how we fit into the Tetrix, man.
Yeah, can we just be humans?
Yes, human. How about humans? One step further, life. Why don't we just...
See, that's my anthropocentrism.
Oh, no, and it's a good, you know, there shouldn't even be a title for what you feel if you feel that way. That should be the way it is. It shouldn't be, well, I'm a... No. We should all just... And we never will. I mean, as a collective, we can only. But the point is with the derecho. No, I'm not tired of hearing about it. In fact, when you say those things, it's good. People need to hear how scared you were when that crap went down, because that crap goes down all the time. And the more dependent we become upon things that are not going to come, the more disappointed we're going to be, and at the wrong time, disappointment can turn into a tragedy.
It's not just the question of dependency. See, I mean, I've got enough of a little core of optimism left in me that, for instance, I feel confident in saying that if we had a distributed grid instead of this antiquated late 19th, early 20th century grid that runs around here, If we had solar panels on every house that was feeding into a distributed grid, well, that wouldn't happen.
And not in a capitalistic nation. They got the.
Well, they're capitalists in Germany, and they got solar panels and wind turbines all over creation.
Yeah. Well, they've got their shit together, I guess. I mean, I'm not over there. I don't know. I'm sure they've got problems. Hell, they had a lot of problems a few years ago. Everything goes in cycles. This is our turn. And to sit around and think that maybe if we hope, well, you know what you say about hope. And I am happy. I don't sound it. And everybody's going to listen to this and they're going to go, oh, that old guy. Oh, my God. I am happy. It's because I'm not putting my faith into what I was told to put my faith into. Because it's just another broken promise. And that means nothing to the person who just climbed up a ladder. Oh, promise. Oh, the weather's nice up here. See you later as they pull it up. I mean, it's not. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen in my world. Again, this is my perception, and I don't want to I don't want to cast despair on everybody. I actually believe there is a solution. It's just not, it's not anything other than finding a way to commune, to get people together.
Well, it's not,
and
the
weather
problem,
this storm,
the problem,
and be able to weather this storm.
The problem with the solution, as I'm guessing you see it, Happy, is that it is a solution that is beyond the reach and the comprehension of a culture that is sunk neck deep in ideas, in the idea that the most important thing in the world is profit.
Oh, yeah. And here comes the boot. They're going to use us as stepping stones across that moggy, across that bog. They don't care. We're just, we are what we are. But you know, we do count. We do matter. You know, the show, you ever see, I'm sure you've seen the movie Network.
Oh yeah.
I'm a human being, God damn it. My life has meaning.
I've also seen Soylent Green.
Yeah. 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 Well, they're not going to come and help us.
I mean, it blows my mind that there's a company out there, again, seeking a profit, that is pitching this nasty, yicky, because I've read some reviews of this stuff, blend of nutritional elements that one mixes with water and oil. And by God, the name of the product is Soylent.
Yeah, he's got a great... I followed that from about a year and a half ago. He did some little blog or did some little thing, and I caught it. And when I finally saw it printed, I think it was in the Smithsonian, or it was in print somewhere, Science Magazine, something.
But my first thought when I saw it was, dude, did you not watch the movie all the way to the end?
Yeah. Yeah, well.
I mean, did nobody in marketing watch this all the way to the end?
Yeah, if you stick to the rule, eat what your ancestors ate 30,000 years ago, we'll be fine. It's especially in the last 20 years, 25 years. I wouldn't trust anything you have to add water to. You know, our bodies have evolved with the food sources around us, not the food sources we created. And I think that's where we're coming up with all these illnesses. You know, you just got to be careful. Don't eat at McDonald's. And by the way, you've got to stop eating those ramen noodles, buddy. They're linking that to cancer now.
No. They're gone. They're so gone.
Yeah, good. That's good. We gotta tell you.
The word came down from Sinai, otherwise known as Agnes, that there will be no more ramen.
Good. That's good. Good. She's looking out for you. You listen to her. But one of these days, I'll call in and I'm gonna let you do your thing, because I've occupied enough time. But one of these days I'll tell you, I did some experimenting a while back with aquaponics. If you get a chance to take a look at that.
I will. Now I'm curious.
Yeah, because that's something, you know, you're worried about the soil and you're worried about the water and you're worried about the conditions in your environment there. And that actually doesn't have to be, that doesn't have to be even an influence in your diet as far as being able to grow your own food. There's a lot of advancements. In fact, I think the Mayans, you'd know better, the Mayans are the ones that discovered it. And it obviously got lost, as did all their knowledge. And just recently here in the last, so I'd say in the last 5 years, it's had a huge surge where people are able to grow their own food inside their house for pennies.
Well, look at what the Mexica people did. I don't know if this falls within the general rubric of aquaponics, but you know, in the Central Valley of Mexico, there was a series. It was one great big lake, but they broke it into three. But it was just one big lake, and down at the southern end, they developed is the word chinampa. It was floating farming.
Yeah, that's what this is. You see, there's a natural link to from fish manure to the food, and then the waste of the food that the human doesn't eat feed back to the fish, and the fish poop in the water, and the water is pumped through the root systems, and you don't have to worry about anything. You don't have to worry about any remediation of the soil. You don't have to do anything. You know, flood the tank for 15 seconds or 15 minutes a day and let it drain, and the plant grows so much faster. I'll send you some stuff. I've been researching it, you know, my long-term goal, me and my gal, we're gonna go get a farm. We're gonna try to farm.
What's that John Prine song, Happy? Blow up your TV, eat a lot of peaches, try to find Jesus on your own. Spanish pipe dream, that's what it is.
Yeah, everything but the Jesus part. Sorry, yeah. No offense. I don't got time for him.
I understand.
It's all
yeah, but
good.
Don't leave out the eat a lot of peaches part.
Definitely.
And it sounds like you've already taken care of the blow up your TV part.
Yes, definitely. Well, actually, I sold it for a pretty penny. Yeah, I was able to make a few bucks off of it. Best money I ever made. But thank you so much for your time. And I really mean it, everybody. Get rid of your television. Convert that money into things that matter. And we know how much this show matters. It's a daily ritual. I hate the weekends. But Bob's got to take a break now and then, don't you, buddy?
Rumor has it. There have been times in the early days of the Horn, Happy, when I was working 6 and 7 days a week, and you know, behind the scenes, in large part, I still am. But the two days of not being on the air are 2 days of trying to do basic crisis management around here. So that's how that plays out. But thank you for the kind words, and this is an evening when we are $145 down on fundraising. So your words are very well taken.
Well, I tell you what, I'm having a garage sale this weekend. Put me down for that 45.
Okay, good deal.
Okay, yeah. And I'll find a way to get it to you, short of sending it to you via cash, because I don't have a credit card, but I think I got my gal on the PayPal. So, knock 45 off of that. Thank you so much for your time, and not just this time, all the time that you spend to make this. I know it's your passion. So I know you get something out of it, I'm sure.
Oh, I do.
But I think it pales in comparison to what we do.
For the last 10 years, this program has provided untold amounts of relief for my family, because there was a time when I was running up and down the road and I'd be listening to the radio and the news and everything, and I'd come blowing through the door, and those goddamn staggering not pull friends elected,
Oh, I know. I've been there. I've been there.
All right.
Thank you, my brother.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime. I hope now that you've broken your lurking habit, it'll stay broken.
I'll try not to drive you crazy.
No.
Overstay my welcome.
No, come back anytime. You are more than welcome.
All right, I look forward to it. You have a good one, my friend.
All right, thank you. Bye now.
Okay, bye.
The happy hippie Billy. Calling from, if I understand correctly, Southern Washington State. Yeah, I can't resist what he was talking about and what it reminded me of. Heck, it's only 2:41.
She was a level-headed dancer on the road to alcohol. And I was just a soldier on the way to Montreal. Well, she pressed her chest against me about the time the jukebox broke. Yeah, she gave me a peck on the back of her neck, and these are the words she spoke. Blow up your TV, throw away your paper, go to the country, build you a home, plant a little garden, eat a lot of peaches, try and find Jesus on your own. Well, I sat there at the table and acted real naive, for I knew that topless lady had something up her sleeve. Well, she danced around the barroom and she did the hoochie coo. Yeah, she sang her song all night long, telling me what to do. Blow up your TV, throw away your paper, go to the country, build you a home, plant a little garden, eat a lot of peaches, try and find Jesus on your own. Well, I was young and hungry,
leaving. Well, she looked me in the face. I said, you must know the answer. She said, no, but I'll give it a try. And to this very day, we've been living our way. Here is the reason why. We blew up our TV, threw our paper, went to the country, built us a home, had a lot of children, fed them on peaches. They all found Jesus on their own.
It's a classic Spanish pipe dream. The one and only, the great, the magnificent John Prine. Let's see. Well, oddly enough, I do come to the program with a stack of stories every evening. Some days it just doesn't work out, though. I'd rather have the conversations anyway. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, you certainly have been at your element tonight, haven't you?
Well, I've been. I thought that first hour and 20 minutes with Carol was magnificent, and then the happy hippie Billy comes in and just makes it even better.
Just a few things, and I definitely believe that brevity is the soul of wit. But first, why was this lady down? She lives in Virginia?
No, Missouri.
Oh, I thought she said she lived in Virginia, had a summer home there.
No, she said Missouri.
Oh.
She lives about 2 hours from Ferguson.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought she said she had a summer home in Virginia or someplace like that. Maybe I just didn't hear properly.
No, she'd been reading about it, and as she explained, grew more and more increasingly frustrated with the poor quality of coverage coming out of there, and decided, you know, being a writer, to go and see it for herself.
So basically, that is her métier, right?
The written word, yes.
Okay. So she basically writes for a living.
I don't know. I think there are very few who write for a living, but she writes.
Okay, I just wondered. We all have to do something for a living, that's for sure. Going back to this thing about cable and stuff like that, I take an opposite view of that because I enjoy film. I enjoy a lot of things that come through the TV. I see a lot of great films, movies, stuff like that, that are in programs that are extremely educational, and you have to pick and choose. There's a lot of crap out there. I'm not one who gets into America Has Talent or some of that other stuff they have on there. But, I mean, you know, I get a lot of opposite points of view and stuff like that, and it enables me to make decisions that I would not be able to make because I wouldn't know what they were talking about. And as far as other means of education are concerned, self-education, well, I have over 5,000 books and read probably 2,000 pages a week. We talked about this before.
Indeed, but, we have.
Yeah, but everything is finite. I mean, as far as the Internet's concerned, the Internet's going to probably get just as bad as you people declare the TV to be.
Oh, in many instances, it already is.
Oh, well, yeah, it certainly is. I mean, you know, take a look at Facebook, some of the stuff you see on there.
Facebook, TMZ is a one domain, single URL sewer.
No, I think TMZ sometimes is a hoot, some of the stuff they say on there. It's a source of comedy, not that I really get into it that much. I'll see something on, you know, the web page, and they'll have something about this, that, and the other, and I'll say, well, what's this idiot done now? And, you know, I can't see anything wrong with that. And they make a good living doing it. That's all there is to it. It is an established program, and as are many others. that aren't worth a damn. But nonetheless,
right, and I'm not going to sit here and say that someone is an unevolved troglodyte because they like to watch Duck Dynasty. It isn't for me, and I don't share the bigoted worldview of the Duck people.
But you don't have to watch it. That's the thing.
It's kind of like
if you live next door to, say, an 85-year-old couple who are nudist, okay? And they walked around with their windows wide open and played air hockey. That's all right. But you don't have to look.
Or you can at least make a concerted effort not to.
Well, they had a good program about Roseanne one time about a couple who did that, and Roseanne and her husband got addicted because they just couldn't turn their eyes away.
Well, see, I think you just defined a whole lot of reality television, Jim.
Well, I love Roseanne. I just love that program. Golden Girls, a lot of stuff you can learn on there. I mean, both those programs, Golden Girls and Roseanne, they were far ahead of their time back in the 80s and 90s with a lot of issues. A lot of issues. This particular program, I saw it today when they lived next door to a couple named the Cornellis who were aged. And, of course, she and Dan were addicted to it and invited them over. And then the Cornellis said, well, after being confronted with their nudism, if we were younger and more attractive, you probably wouldn't find it so terrible for us to live the way we do.
Yeah.
And, you know, and of course, and Roseanne said, well, at least not for a while. Well, I mean, people just have natural predilections about certain things like that. They just do. I mean, you know, you don't have to watch. I mean, there's a lot of stuff on all types of media.
Well, I can say for a fact, we've been cableless for a year now.
Good for you.
And
I'm glad.
And we are not, I don't find my life wanting. There are moments where they're a little bit annoying or inconvenient, but those are related to my own personal failings.
Yeah, but you have other means of accessing film and stuff like that.
Well, sure. I mean, as far as film is concerned,
yeah.
Rather than that's the difference between old and new media, Jim. Old media says that you have to go through the listings and find when it's on and be there when they decide to show it to you. The newer model, if it holds up, is that if at 3 o'clock in the morning I want to watch Soylent Green, I don't have to depend on some broadcast network to show it to me.
Well,
I can go and watch it.
You know, but also through the other types of media that you don't have, you can pick and choose what you want to look at.
Yeah, and for the most part,
I mean, you have what you use DVDs and what's the other thing?
We're almost exclusively online on online content now. I can't remember the last time I put a DVD in a DVD player.
Huh. Well, that's the thing about you buy a DVD and spend a lot of money on it, and then.
Just a sec. Nope. That is absolutely hilarious. Stand by, please. Goddess of Irony, that was... Okay, I know. We get some, too, now and then. But that was really particularly inconvenient. I'll be back in a minute. Well, that was certainly funny. there for a couple of minutes, the entire interweb tubes just died. Just got a note in from the Happy Hippie Billy. He said, "I broke the internet. I'm so sorry. Solar flare? LOL." No, I think this is just an incompetent ISP. Which in its own way can be as devastating as a solar flare, I think. Great note coming in a few minutes ago. And I'm sorry, Jim. I'm sorry our conversation was cut short. I really did not cut you off. But anyway, great little piece of correspondence coming in from our friend Steve in China. Steve writes, "Conversation is so interesting this evening. You know, a lot of these problems, political, social, or what have you, are due to our popular misconceptions concerning memory and the processing of information. Science is finding out that our memories aren't things just hardwired into the structure of our brains, but are actually spontaneously and repeatedly created anew each and every time we have a particular emotional response, good or bad, to whatever is out there in the general conscious environment. In other words, rather than the classical idea of rational and emotional responses to whatever it is that creates or recreates a memory, it appears that our memories, and hence our ego-centered perceptions, are virtually emotional. We tap into many levels of emotional reactions to the local environment. Visual, auditory, tactile, even our sense of balance and orientation in space are components of memory. Hence," Steve continues, "the prevalence of false memory, or several people disagreeing about what has been seen or heard. Rationality is a category of organization. Memory is an outcome of having a positive or negative emotional response." Whoa. Makes you wonder about those political figures who would urge calm, emotionless responses to great crises. "We should be emotional," Steve says. "It's the sociopath who cannot have, but must fake, an emotional response." No, Jim, I did not hang up. Thank you, Steve. And there's an example. The fact that this little conversation is taking place, in the midst of, from a studio in West Virginia, with input coming from China. Wouldn't you love to have Sherman set the Wayback Machine for 1829 and go explain that to little Jimmy Madison? And by the way, just by way, I do this from time to time. Dr. Bill is always a font of profoundly valuable information. And he's been parking them in the cheap seats yesterday and today. I heartily encourage you to go and get his program for yesterday and today. You know, the podcast feed address is at whiterosesociety.org under the subdomain for his program. Or just download the files. But these 3 days are going to be magic. The first 2 days already have been, and I have a feeling, based on a conversation I had, he's just itching to get to 1 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time tomorrow and continue this discussion. Because the idea that the people who put together the idea itself of this government couldn't see past their own noses, well, it's just not true. And to have James Madison putting forward the prognostications that he did in 1829, well, what you got earlier today is Dr. Bill sharing the entirety of the letter in which he does that. And it is so very much worth your time. And, of course, he welcomes calls and he welcomes dialogue and discussion. So if you're of a mind to participate, you're welcome so to do. Live at 1 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, which would be, what, 10 o'clock Pacific? Yeah. And I would be remiss if I did not note that this evening's fundraising has gone kind of sideways. We need to raise $145 in the next 14 to 22 hours and 14 minutes so as not to be in a hole tomorrow for prayer meeting Wednesday. That package that Sparky referenced being on its way is on its way. We will have, hopefully, yes, tomorrow afternoon we will have some jalapeno pistachio stories. Maybe, who knows, for prayer meeting Wednesday, a cautionary tale of the fires of the real living burning hell. With sort of an idea toward looking toward, I guess I should have said the PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. So too with the address for the traditional U.S. Postal Service mailing routine. But with a sort of a nod toward the topicality of any given Wednesday around here. An interesting story from the folks at 350.org. I got a blast email earlier today. From the folks at 350. I'm on their list. And apparently there's a new campaign at 350.org . They are asking the Vatican. They are asking Pope Francis to put actions behind his recent strong words. They write, "It's wrong to wreck the planet. If it's wrong to wreck the planet, then it's wrong to profit from that wreckage. The movement to divest from fossil fuels has always hinged on a fundamentally moral argument. Investment in the fossil fuel industry is wrong. Climate change is unjust." These are precepts that Christians and non-Christians alike can agree on. In the past 2 years, hundreds of universities, cities, and faith communities have rallied around the idea of fossil fuel divestment, calling on institutions to align their investments with their moral principles and send a clear symbolic message. The actions of the industry are incompatible with a livable planet, and we are taking a stand against it. Note very clearly that in the language of this post, even 350.org notes that this is a symbolic message, because if every morally, ethically, conscience-driven organization on the planet divests from the fossil fuel industry, the fossil fuel industry is not going to collapse. Because there is always going to be somebody out there who wants those profits. And so even if all of that happened, you know, somebody would snap them up. Some billionaire or millionaires in gathering of same, or maybe just some rotten right-wing institution. They're calling on the Vatican here to divest from fossil fuels. Well, you think the Southern Baptist Convention wouldn't buy up whatever the Roman Catholic Church sold? At this point in time, given the scandals that it's had to deal with, the Southern Baptist could probably buy the Roman Catholic Church for what it's worth and sell it for what they think they're worth. But nonetheless, I understand the symbolic message, and I appreciate 350 at least acknowledging that the message is indeed symbolic. They continue, "Many leaders have responded with institutions like the Unitarian Universalists, the United Church of Christ, and the World Council of Churches committing to fossil fuel divestment in just the past few months. In June, the University of Dayton became the first Catholic university to divest. The tide is turning. Now it's time to divest the Vatican. With the ear of 1.2 billion Catholics and the respect of Christians and non-Christians alike, Pope Francis is uniquely positioned to add both his voice and the unique moral power of his office to the divestment movement. In the coming months, Pope Francis plans to release an encyclical, one of the highest forms of Catholic teaching on humanity's role in caring for the earth. The Pope understands the threat of climate change. He understands the moral imperative of caring for creation. He understands that if we do nothing, then the impacts of climate change will be horrific and will fall hardest on the world's most vulnerable people. He gets that humans are responsible for protecting the planet and ourselves. It will be interesting to see. It will indeed be interesting to see. Oh, right, right, right. Yes, I just got a note from the happy hippie Billy. He said, yeah, I'm sorry if I didn't make it clear. I have a tendency of babble. He says, I'm in for $45. So actually, the fundraising goal as we move toward the last 7 minutes of the program is more like 100. In the email that I received, on this divestment movement, I sort of balk when I see reference to the ruination of the planet. And I just, not because I have a philosophical disagreement, but because when we say things like destroy the planet, that climate change will destroy the planet, no, it won't. And I think we need to be careful about that language, because when we get stuff manifestly wrong, we give power to the other side. They're saying we're going to destroy the planet with fossil fuels. We couldn't possibly destroy the planet with fossil fuels. No, what is at stake is the ability of humans and a lot of other animals to live on the planet. Venus is a perfectly lovely planet. Nice, thick atmosphere. Only problem is, it cannot support life as we understand it. Mars must have been a wonderful planet when it had an atmosphere. It's pretty interesting without one. It's my understanding there's an interesting phenomenon that won't happen for another 250 years or so going on this evening. Lottie and Devin in the chat room can probably expand on that, but the moon and Mars being near each other or something like that. I'm going to go outside in a little bit and see what I can see. But let's bear things in proper perspective. It is our ability to go on being a viable species on the planet that is at stake. Thanks to everybody who wandered by the chat room this evening. We got a nice little crowd going in there once again. It's always fun watching the chat room screen move along and see what people are thinking. Hope you'll be here tomorrow evening for prayer meeting Wednesday. I look forward to that as much as you do in any given week. It's fun just to kind of let go and point and hoot at the weirdos and the hypocrites and the religion industry faithful. Thanks to you all for keeping all of this going. I say that every evening because every evening it is true. You keep this going. And all of us, the whole community, extends its thanks. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy, moderators in the Horn chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACAC.org. Thank you to Carol Baker for joining us in conversation this evening. I found it, as I hope you did, enlightening, informative, and inspiring. Thank you. Thank you, Carol. And always, always, always. Gina, it's all for you.